Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Annie Leibovitz, whose latest book is Annie Leibovitz at Work. I think it was last year there was an exhibit around the country of your photographs, which was material, I think, from that book of 2 or 3 years ago, right?
From Photographer's Life. And it actually was here at the Legion of Honor just a few months ago, and it's now at the National Portrait Gallery in London. It's actually not going to tour as much as the 1970-1990 Chapter 1 episode. It's probably about 7 or 8 places, and then we're going to bring it on home.
Are you happy with the way the photographs are set up there?
The Legion of Honor was stunning. I mean, you know, first of all, Legion of Honor is stunning. And having lived in San Francisco and having family here, it meant so much to drive out there and have that show in that museum. It was pretty great. It doesn't get any better than that. The show was in Paris. I sort of didn't expect much from it being there. It was in the photography museum there, European Photography Museum, and it turned out to be a very emotional, touching show because it was a place where Susan, of course, spent a lot of time. It was like a second home for her, so it turned out to be a sort of a very, very emotional setting there. But it changes every time it's set up, depending on the rooms, of course. The National Portrait Gallery in London, I wish they had 10 more feet. it seems to stop suddenly, and I was saying, can't you get 10 more feet?
Well, I noticed in your book, Annie Leibovitz at Work, that lighting plays such a role in photography itself, and I wonder when you're doing a photographic exhibit, you know, how much the lighting plays in your own mind when you're actually observing the photographs or other people are observing the photographs.
Well, the whole museum world is quite interesting. I mean, you'll see people walk around with meters trying to, you know, see what light is coming in into the room, and I'll say, oh, it doesn't really matter. You know, I'll give you another print if that fades. You know, I'd like to have more light. But, you know, I've been in all kinds of museums. In fact, it happened here at the Legion of Honor. There was there's a skylight that was covered up. And I said, open it up. Please open it up. I don't want this to feel like a dark cave. You know, when you walk through this show, it's already pretty sad as it is. And, you know, there's light, you know, at the end of the tunnel. And I said, please. And the curators were quite surprised. And they said, really? Is it okay? Can we put all that light on the pictures? And I said, yes, please. You know, please open it up. And they did. Because one of the most beautiful things about the Legion of Honor's renovation was that fantastic, you know, skylight, you know, going down into the earth. So I said, please open it up. And they did. Let me talk a little bit about this book because it was funny. I was somewhere and someone said, oh, my gosh, it's so small. I mean, I always meant for it to be. You're going to laugh, but I wanted it to be basically a pamphlet, like, you know, a small book that was more or less a primer for photography. And it was originally going to be about the making of 10 photographs, sort of dissect them and take it apart and really talk about how the photographs were conceived and how they were made. And then I sat down to start working on this book, and there were a lot more interesting ideas that came out of sitting down and talking with Sharon Delano, who helped me, by the way, with the introduction to Photographer's Life. And I saw something, you know, much, much more interesting sort of evolve. So then it turned into this 240-page little small book. But there's many more words than there are pictures. So your question about light, I mean, it's interesting because it
plays such a role in the book.
Sure. Well, yeah. It plays such a role in photography. I mean, you wouldn't have anything, you know, without it. You know,
right.
It's really about the art of light and the science of light. And, you know, you see it actually one more time. It's kind of a chronological order of the photographs that were picked to talk about. But, you know, the beginning work was all reportage, and you had the light that was in front of you. It's not like you really had much control over that. And then, you know, as I started to do the covers for Rolling Stone, then, you know, you needed to start to light, you know, because we discovered that the color wasn't going to print on the rag paper.
Annie Leibovitz, this book, you said it began with the idea of a pamphlet. I mean, did this come out?
Sounds funny, yeah.
Well, A Photographer's Life came out like 2 years ago.
Right.
And at that point, did you suddenly say, well, there's more to say and I want to say it?
No, I mean, I've always had a 4-book contract with Random House, and I had done Women, the book with Susan Sontag. I did American Music, which I wasn't so happy with. I didn't feel like I quite achieved what I wanted to do. And then You know, I was going to work on the retrospective, the follow-up to 1970-1990, which was going to be 1990 to 2005, which became Photographer's Life. You know, the events sort of took over when Susan died, my father died, the children were being born. It suddenly hit me that, you know, 1990 to 2005 were the years I was with Susan, and I just said, you know, I'm going to approach this book, I'm going to approach looking at these pictures as if Susan was standing, you know, to my side, you know, picking them out. So after Photographer's Life came out, it was such a emotional roller coaster, that book, in all the most wonderful ways. I had managed to talk Random House into including in my contract a little book, which I always wanted to make for years. You know, I've been talking about this book for over 10 years about doing a reference book, a reference material book for me for teaching. I've always wanted to teach eventually. I plan to teach somewhere down the line. And I was worried about being able to remember anything. And after all those years, you know, on the Rolling Stone tour, you know, I wanted to do something that was more academic. And there's great examples, you know, in photographic history. I mean, Ansel Adams did a book called Examples, where, you know, he talks about the making of his photographs actually in a lot of depth. I mean, unbelievable depth. You know, of course, you know, Weston's day books. I mean, this is not that.
What it struck me is that you're forming a balance between the layperson reading it, so I could read it and go, hey, hanging out with Queen Elizabeth, cool, and other people who are looking for more. And that's why, for me, it's fun, because I can now ask you about certain questions that are in the book where you do go into depth, but you don't explain why. So,
well, I mean, here is kind of what happened. Was the pictures I was going to talk about were not going to be necessarily the most famous ones or the best known ones. And actually, the Queen episode did happen last year, and I remember calling Sharon. I was in Europe at the time, and I said, oh, come on, let's just answer every question that anyone's ever had. And I think it would be a good exercise, actually, just go ahead and instead of, you know, trying to be so correct and try to take photographs and talk about the process so much, which I think eventually you do, it is in there. Anyway, it was funny working with Sharon, because Sharon didn't know a thing about photography, and I thought that was a good thing.
Right.
Because the most important things about photography, you know, about being a photographer is really learning how to see. And I try to emphasize, again, this is a book hopefully for a young photographer or someone thinking about going into photography, that I try to emphasize, even though I'm not exactly the best example, that it isn't about the equipment, that you can put that equipment aside and take the best pictures that have ever been taken. So you just need light and you need that box. And then it basically, but if you actually get through the whole book, you just learn the lessons that I learned, you know, which is there's no smoke and mirrors. It's a lot of work.
You did an interview for a German magazine that I found online, and you say, when I take a picture, I get 10% of what I see, and the rest is all the work that I do, which is an interesting point, because I know that on some instinctive level, you're seeing more than your eyes are necessarily seeing.
Always, always. And, you know, that's the limit of the medium. I mean, you're only going to get a little bit of something. That's why I sort of laugh when I hear someone say, oh, you really captured that person, or,
right,
you know, I don't believe in it. I mean, I believe it is possible, but I don't believe it's something you can do every day, and it really sort of depends, you know, on so many things. But it's not going to be just something that, oh, I'm popping in today. I want to capture your soul today. You know, I mean, actually, I was thinking about it the other day, and I thought, you know, if I had about a year with each person, I probably could do it. I probably could do it. Because you would probably want to get rid of me eventually and send me home and say, okay, here's me. This is me. This is the real me, you know, whatever that real me is. But basically, I'm just saying, you know, you are only getting such a small part of a moment of a life.
I know that for me, I mean, I always read these books and then I get online. I know that 90% of what I get, it's not going to necessarily be in the interview, except that I'll be walking in with something underneath. You know, so I read this book cover to cover, but I'm not sure going in how much I'm going to actually use, but it's all there on some level.
Exactly. Yeah, you're the first person I met who actually read it all the way through.
It's an easy read. It's not a hard read.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is. It's like it's a little... little bites all the way through.
Well, let me ask you something.
It was hard to do.
Well, you had a person working with you, but let me ask you about a few things that, you know, there's a point where we all know that in some respect we get more out of making mistakes than we do out of getting something perfect, which just happens to be serendipitous.
Mm-hmm.
There's a photo of Bette Midler in there. And it's interesting for me because that particular photo, you complain about how she's underlit. And what do you mean specifically by that?
Literally, the light's coming from underneath her so that it's not, can't be flattering. And, you know, I'm not really – at that time, I'm just learning how to use artificial light. And I basically – in those days, I would just throw a light up. And if it lit something up, that was enough. That's the thing. If you do something long enough and you stay with it long enough, you want to make it better and you learn and – how to, you know, eventually, you know, light. But, you know, I came from a place where I didn't know anything about lighting and wish I did have some kind of knowledge about that. But the Bette Midler is in a section on conceptual work, and it's some of the very early conceptual work. And there's also a couple of photographs there, Tess Gallagher and Robert Penn Warren, which was actually done not for Rolling Stone, but for Life magazine. That was really the big breakthrough, not about lighting, but about content, about, you know, in a setup photograph. And it was very hard to, it was interesting to learn how to talk about, I always talked about those photographs, but I realized when I finally saw it written down, it didn't mean anything. You know, it was like, that sounded like gobbledygook, and I had to really stretch and say what it meant, why those pictures were so important, because they're not necessarily very good photographs, but they represent a moment where, you know, I read Robert Penn Warren's poetry and I read Tess Gallagher's poetry, and I consciously knew I was trying to represent their poetry in the photographs. So that was the beginning. I mean, that's in a little chapter about trying to figure it out.
Annie Leibovitz, in the book, you do talk about the difference between getting a great photograph or a good photograph and getting one that's flattering, and that you're not looking for a flattering photograph. You're looking for something else.
Well, worse than that, I didn't really know how to do a flattering picture when I first started. I didn't really understand what that meant. I mean, I can you imagine coming out of reportage, you know, like, you know, that, you know, finding out that Barbara Streisand has a side or something? I mean, it's those things. I didn't quite understand those, you know, any of that. So that was the whole learning process.
Yeah, but as you learn, then at a certain point, you have to make the decision. I mean, if you're doing something that's, let's say it's not supposed to be specifically flattering, but you're trying to capture the portrait of the person or doing it on your own, you have to make that balance between, is this person going to like it or am I going to be truthful?
Truthful isn't truthful. I mean, what is truthful? I mean, that's a whole other thing. I remember being sort of shocked to find out that there were people in Avedon's pictures that he photographed who didn't like their photographs, because I loved Avedon's pictures, you know, and it turned out that most people he photographed didn't like them. You know, it was just a big, you know, surprise to me. The reality is I didn't really know how to be flattering. It's funny, as you get older, you sort of feel that everyone has a right to look good in their picture, you know.
Right.
You sort of, you know, you're on their side, you know. It's like,
right,
why
yeah.
not? Which is one of the reasons I'm going to stick to portraiture and not journalism. I'd like to think that there's a middle ground, you know, and you can say something about somebody and they can still look all right. I mean, the truth is, I sweat it because I really don't think I know how to take necessarily a flattering picture of somebody. It's not really my forte. In the beginning, in the work, when I had to start lighting, you know, no one looked, you know, normal. And by the nature of it, artificial light is going to look not real. I mean, we don't walk around being lit like that. I remember finally seeing, like, Nan Golden's work. It was a turning point for me. I actually, at the same time, I was looking at my mother's photographs with Kodak Gold, you know, a film where, you know, it was a high-speed color negative, and thinking, I liked my mom's pictures and Nan Golden's pictures. I was thinking, this is so interesting to see this kind of very natural-looking color, and people really look like themselves. And it was relaxed, and I was really inspired by that. And I actually shifted from transparency, which magazines demanded that you use, to color negative. And I got hell from it from the printers of the magazines. I was changing their whole system. They were used to using transparency to separate from. And I just said, look, I'm out there in the field, and you know, I have much more latitude with color negative. I don't want to shoot transparency. And it took a while. But, you know, everyone, you know, most photographers shifted over to color negative before they finally went to digital. And digital is amazing because you need less light. I mean, you can almost shoot in the dark. So I find myself working with less light and less assistance right now. And it's really, really interesting.
Well, this is a really current thing, because when I spoke with you about a photographer's life, you were just starting to get into digital at that time. And you're going, well, I stayed away from it because of the artificial reality. And then suddenly I'm looking in here and those pictures of the Queen and all of that, that's all digital. The learning curve was...
I came into it sort of backwards because, you know, when I went to go do digital, I suddenly found there were suddenly 16 more people in the studio. It was like there had to be a room and three towers and like a, it was like a production. And I just said, I remember one of the first people I photographed digitally was Jane Fonda, and there was like noise on the screen or something. I don't know. It was just something so horrible. I had such a horrible time that I didn't want to do it. And then, you know, all the equipment has gotten better, and some of the new 35mm cameras with their, you know, their big picture backs. I basically now, you know, am shooting more like film than I ever shot before, where, you know, I'm by myself. I may have one assistant with me with maybe one light source. And the mistake I was making, of course, is I was trying to process as I photographed. And I think it's a big mistake. You should just shoot like I used to do and then bring the work back, then look at it. And that's kind of what I'm doing. It's great. It's fun.
So it's like pretending that you're creating a contact sheet even though it's already there in your camera to look at.
I try not to look at it as I'm shooting it because it just slows everything down and you're not really taking pictures. I can't say I don't look at it.
You know, right.
It's really has taken the place of like a Polaroid. But again, this, I'm in the middle of learning about it, and I don't know it yet. I'm still figuring it out.
It's funny. Speaking of Polaroids, you say in the book a couple of places that, you know, you use the Polaroids to set up the shots to figure it out, and then you look and go, hey, these Polaroids are better than the final product.
Well, that's the other thing that happened. I mean, it's actually so sad to me to lose the beautiful black and white Polaroids that I shot a lot with, and it would happen time and time again that the Polaroid would be better than the actual film. That's sort of normal. And again, with digital, you get to shoot. You get to keep what you call your Polaroid, and then you're on to shooting your shots, hopefully. So like, it seems to me the best of both worlds. But I miss the beautiful rendering in those black and white 667 Polaroid. They're so beautiful. I did a lot of my work that way. And I am looking to find a medium format camera that is going to have a faster digital back. I think that they're in the process of trying to work that out. But I mourn the loss of those Polaroid negatives because Polaroid is gone, basically. But something else has sort of taken its place. You sort of have to be now. You have to work with what you have now. And I remember in the 70s, when Kodachrome 2 just kind of was taken off the market, and I remember a lot of photographers ran out and bought boxes and boxes of it and put it in refrigerators and try to hold on. And that, you know, in the long run, that's why it's so important not to hold on to the equipment and in your head and the film and everything. It's really what you see. I've always thought it was more important. Content is always more important, you know, than your camera or the kind of film you're using.
If you're talking to an amateur photographer who wants to take better pictures and they were to ask you, how do you avoid cliche in taking even a tourist shot? Is there any simple way that you could say, listen, this is how you need to look?
Don't you feel like there's so much imagery out there now, I don't even know what the cliches are right now. Do you? Think about it. I mean, being able to just pick up your phone, this all-purpose machine and port a memory. I mean, it's so beautiful. Some of the imagery on the iPhones that I've seen of people's children, and it's sort of like carrying the picture in the wallet. I mean, it really is taking that place. I went to a Patti Smith concert, and I was sitting behind a woman who had her cell phone, I mean, her phone with the camera in it. And I was watching the concert. She was sitting right in front of me. I was watching the concert through her camera. She was holding up and taking these pictures. I said, God, those are good. Those are really, really good, those pictures. I mean, how do you avoid a cliche? Or I don't know. I mean, when I was going to school, for example, I knew that it was like the art school photograph was the dead seagull on the beach or something. I don't know.
Let's switch gears a little because you've talked with so many famous people, you've met them, and I know you have to be a little careful because you may be meeting with them again, so obviously you don't want to
say that in the book too.
So let's put this in a more positive light. I'm just going to throw out some names, and you did work with Barack Obama. Okay, what was he like in private?
Well, I mean, I the best way I can describe him is to say he's been consistent. He's just very personable and down to earth and kind and soft spoken. And I was on the road with him, and I was having a problem with one of my nannies just quit, and you know, it's like, I can't believe I was even talking to him about that. And he said, well, Michelle had the same problem. She broke into tears when blah, blah, blah. And so he has a lot of empathy and as a one-on-one relationship. Yeah. And he has great grace. I just think it's such a new day right now. It's just such a powerful time. The thing is, I had the opportunity to photograph him throughout this process, of him, being elected. And I saw him sort of become stronger and more serious, but still very, very, personable. Actually, people always, they ask me about Barack Obama, but actually the most remarkable thing about being on the road with him was really, it's hard to describe because when you see it on TV, you don't really quite get it, is those rallies and those halls, the people. That's when you just knew something was coming. You saw the empowerment and the hope in people's faces and like I've never seen before. And, I lived in Berkeley. We've seen it. We've seen a lot. And, finally, our day has come. I mean, it's just a beautiful, extraordinary moment. I'm going to start crying now.
Well, back in 2001, you did a group portrait involving his predecessor, and you kind of made the comment. I made him put his hands in his, we're talking about Bush, where
right.
I made him put his hands in his pockets right. That he had this certain bizarre swagger to him or something. I mean,
cocky. It was always cocky. I mean, we did a series, Bono and I did a series for Vanity Fair, The Red Covers. Was it last summer? I can't remember exactly. Maybe the summer before. And Obama was part of that series, and Bush was part of the series. And I remember going in and photographing him and Condoleezza Rice and thinking, he looks too good. I mean, he's going to sleep at night. I mean, I don't understand. When we're going through this war in this time, he should just look like Lyndon B. Johnson. He should look terrible. It just bothered me that he just looked like he came out of the spa or something. I mean, I just, he's not taking the toll that the rest of us, are. It's like it was bothersome. I mean, it's not my duty. It's not part of my job to say any of this. I do have to go in and do my job. That picture is strange how it's sort of will probably be one of my more important pictures because it happened just at a time right after 9/11 and, all those people were pulled together. Can't believe that, we got into the White House to take that picture. And it's a strong historical picture because all his group are together. But it's more historical than anything else. We didn't know that at that time they were just planning the Iraq wars.
The sense I get from your saying it is that there was an arrogance there that you would see that may not even be in the picture.
Well, he's a great politician. I mean, he's a smart guy. I mean, in that respect. I mean, he knows how to be with people.
How about you work with Hillary Clinton?
I actually supported her run for the Senate. When Obama came along, it was hard to sort of give up that idea of Hillary. But I just in my gut saw early on that Obama was right for this time he was going to make the change that we needed. She can be a very silly and funny, and I'm not saying anything that anyone doesn't
right,
know.
Yeah, yeah.
So, very, very warm.
Did you ever get a chance to photograph Brando?
I did not. I was supposed to, and it fell through. I would have liked to have done that.
Over the years, you've done all of these portraits of famous people and important people. Any of them that, for some reason, specifically intimidated you before walking in?
The Queen was a little along those lines. I mean, I think there was a lot to do. I mean, it's like when you first meet someone, you don't know how it's going to go. You really, I had the opportunity to meet her the night before we photographed. And, obviously she comes with, a lot of protocol. But she actually turned out to be, which is what was so, hard and upsetting about the BBC interpretation was that, she may have been a little bit cranky at the beginning of the shoot, but she had just great, great resolve and stayed until I said we were done, but that there was a moment in the shoot when she said, I'm not a really very good dresser. It was a very disarming thing to say. She sort of was very quiet. She says, I'm not really a very good dresser. She does her own hair and makeup.
Yeah, well, I noticed in that you took backgrounds from the outside and put them on. This is something that you had never done prior to the rise of digital. What made you decide to move in that direction?
I did a lot of research, of course, on the Queen. I mean, she's probably the most photographed person in the world over the longest time. I've always loved the Cecil Beaton work that he's done with the royal family. And I was a little frustrated because I was hoping to get her outside, and they said, well, it actually happened to be sort of warmish, but they were still holding their ground that she wouldn't go outside, and if she was going to go outside, that she was going to have to wear her day clothes, that she couldn't be dressed up outside. And I reminded them of the pictures of the Queen Mother that Cecil Beaton had done outside, where she was dressed in a beautiful dress, but they weren't hearing anything of it. I had to make up my mind whether I wanted to photograph her outside in day clothes, because they said I could do it, but she would be looking, not very special. And I thought that if I was going to have this one chance to take her picture, and they were offering me all the other possibilities of her dressed in grandeur as the monarch, I thought that was too hard to sort of pass up. It seemed so wonderful. Literally, I think the day or two before I was supposed to shoot, I suddenly had this idea. I said, well, Cecil Beaton brought in his flowered backgrounds into Buckingham Palace and posed the royal family in front of them. And I said, why couldn't I take a digital background of the garden and place her in front of that? So when she walked into the room for our photo shoot, I showed her my photographs of the garden and told her what I wanted to do. And I think that actually calmed her down, and she was kind of interested because the garden, of course, looks so stark and strong and beautiful.
Well, when you sit there yourself in Photoshop, you have other people with you when you're doing something like that?
I'm laughing because I work with Pascal Dangan, who's probably has taken the digital work to the farthest as it can go. Right now, he's always constantly interested in printing, and I don't always sit with him, but he has a couple people who work with him, and they come over to my studio, and I sit there, and I actually have a little pointer. Will, who works with me, one of Pascal's people, flinches every time I take the pointer onto the screen and actually literally, say, well, do this, move this a little over here or there, and literally I sit with someone who knows how to use the computer, and I guess we do it together. I would like to do less with it, as much as I can, but I find, you can do a few things. You are printing the picture. You're processing and printing it, so you have to output it. That seems to be still the area that's really tough, is you have what you want on screen, you can't get it to output the way.
Right.
There's a whole other... The Canon repair person lives in our design studio. I mean, she's comes every other day to calibrate, or something, the copier, but it's definitely frustrating.
Annie Leibovitz, several months ago, I interviewed David Reif, and he was not happy with the fact that you'd done this exhibit. In retrospect, knowing that his reaction would be that way, do you think you would have done it any differently?
No. Death hits us all in different ways, and you have to respect, everyone's reaction. It's surprising. I mean, that's what Joan Didion's book is all about. I mean, the year of magical thinking is really a euphemism for just being a little bit crazy. And there's nothing I could have done that was going to come out one way or the other. We don't really get along, I didn't quite realize to what extent until Susan died. And, I think he has his own issues. And of course, with losing him, he lost his mother. That was its own relationship there, a very, very special relationship. And I think that, he would never be happy with anything that was done. I think he wanted her all to himself. If there's a criticism to his book, it's that, there was no one else there.
Well, the sense I got from reading his book was that, and from talking to him, is in a way that was deliberate on his part, and he knew that just because this was his way of dealing with grief. I mean, that was...
Well, I think that's his way of dealing with everything. Yes, that's what I'm trying to say, is I really supported David and helped David in many, many ways over the years that I was with Susan. And so it was hard to sort of, come to this place that we're at. But on some level, as time goes on, you sort of understand that everyone has their own way of dealing with what they have to deal with. So I respect that with him. And there were many more people in Susan's life than just David.
Andy Leibovitz, a couple other questions. Last year I interviewed the author of a biography of Leni Riefenstahl, and it made me think about the nature of photography as propaganda. What are your thoughts on that? And what are your thoughts on seeing a film like Triumph of the Will?
Well, I know I'm not Susan Sontag when it comes to talking about this. It's probably why I'm more comfortable in the genre of portrait photography that has its own issues, that I do take responsibility, you know, for my own perceptions and judgments when I'm taking my pictures. You know, I do think that photography has been used for every single purpose. You know, I think that Leni Riefenstahl, you know, had a style that, you know, as much as you know, I don't want to get myself in too much hot water here, but, you know, I think that her skiing, you know, Alps photographs, you know, were, you know, came long before. I think she really believed in what she was doing, you know, and it was about form, and it was certainly, you know, taken to task, and you know it, you know, at the wrong time, I think, you know. You know, she had a way of seeing things. I think it was totally built in. I don't think it was. I think that's the way she thought. So, yeah.
There's almost a parody photo in this book of Arnold Schwarzenegger in a Leni Riefenstahl kind of pose.
And I was very uncomfortable with that picture for a long time. And what makes me sort of relax with it a little bit, because, you know, it was all about form, that picture. And actually, I was unhappy with my Olympic work from 1996 because I couldn't sort of get beyond, in a still photograph, you know, Leni Riefenstahl in the back of my head, and I actually felt that work was a failure on some level. It was beautiful, but it was like, you know, there you go again. We're missing something.
Does that happen a lot? I mean, where you kind of walk away and you go, you know, if I just had one more photo, I could do it right this time.
Well, in retrospect, I feel like with Arnold, it wasn't bad that it had that connotation.
Right.
I mean, I think it kind of gave it its idea. I mean, to me, it wasn't good at the time that I photographed it. It wasn't good enough because it was all about form. But then form for Arnold turned out to be an interesting idea, not a bad idea.
Well, but I mean, when I look at the picture as opposed to some of the other pictures, suddenly there are all these cultural overlays. It in a way, it reminds me of, I don't know if the, I think there's an example in there from The Sopranos, but, you know, the, and it, talking about a cliche in a group photo, the idea of doing the Last Supper, you know, in a group photo,
yeah,
where suddenly you've got these, all of these other things that are invading the space of the picture.
You know, the Sopranos, I mean, you know, we photographed that in about, you know, 2 minutes, but it is a section of the book on groups, and
right, yeah,
and I am sort of talking about the problems or the difficulties with shooting groups, and I think the Bush picture is actually in that section, and there's a section, there's a photograph also from Herbert Allen's conference in Sun Valley. Using The Last Supper for The Sopranos, I mean, this book really does venture off and also talks about advertising work and
right,
talks about some photographs that you don't sort of expect, you know, to be, you know, if I had the opportunity to edit a book, you know, that there would be pictures in there that just to sort of bring, to show the whole range. But, you know, if you're going to conceptualize photographs and portraits and groups or single, whatever you're doing, you know, you live in the world and you are reading and you are inspired and you're influenced. You're not going to be original, particularly. You're going to feed off of, you know, everything else that's going on. I think a great example is Tina Fey doing Sarah Palin. I mean, it's how powerful was comedy? How powerful was that? You know, and that's one of the good things that, you know, art can do, is it's just basically feeding it back to you. I mean, the ideas come from everywhere. You know, there's no holding back.
Final question. You talk about a vocabulary of styles, different ways to work. What's your favorite? I mean, if you could pick one that kind of makes you go, yeah, All right, I got another one of this kind to do. Cool.
Again, that journey is in the book. There's one of the very last chapters is called Being There, and it's really about – there happens to be a story about Philip Johnson, and I was lucky enough to get an appointment to go see the Glass House, and I didn't expect him to be there, and, you know, I was kind of grumpy that he was there, and he was kind of grumpy that I was grumpy that he, you know, that he was there. I was pretty much by myself with my camera, and I just took some photographs, and again, he was just standing next to a window in the Glass House looking out, and I, you know, those are still the best pictures, you know, that when things just happen in front of you. You know, I'm not saying the setup picture is something I don't love also, but and that's the yin. That's the other thing about the work. That's the yin and the yang of it. Is that tension between finding the photograph, just finding something in front of you, you know, sort of untouched, and then also directing a photograph. You know, so you know, I'm always torn between what's the right thing to do about that. But if I had my druthers, I'd rather just, you know, discover it.
You've been listening to an interview with Annie Leibovitz, whose latest book is Annie Leibovitz at Work. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.